I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A two-month-old truce in Iraq that was tenuous to begin with is on shakier ground today, with fighting between Iraqi insurgents and coalition forces. An American helicopter was shot down in Najaf. Elsewhere in the country, two Iraqi police officers were killed, and a suicide car bombing south of Baghdad killed at least five. Also, fighting in the relatively calm city of Mosul in northern Iraq has left at least 22 people dead. A short while ago, we spoke with Scott Baldoff, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, in a still-tense Najaf. We asked him, first of all, about reports quoting radical Shiite leader Muqtada al-Sadr as saying that the ceasefire is over because of the actions of the occupation forces. The situation has started to deteriorate. American forces attacked first.
They say that the battle started about 12:30, starting with some small arms fire, and then about 4 o'clock in the morning, the American troops supposedly moved in with helicopter gunships and also with Hummers and with Bradley vehicles to fire onto the Sadr office in Najaf. But, you know, honestly, we haven't been able to get any confirmation from U.S. troops yet. This is a new unit here, the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit. So we are still trying to get our connections with them. But they, I'm sure, have a different story to tell.
Does all the fighting seem to be related to insurgents associated with Muqtada al-Sadr?
Yes, absolutely. There's actually a bit of an irritation among the people here in Najaf that we've talked to. For much of the battle, we were in an area which was not very favorable to the Sadr group, but they had no choice. They themselves were not armed. Many of the people whose homes we were taking shelter in. So there is irritation a bit with the Sadr people, because those are the gunmen who are out on the streets. And many of the people would actually like to see some peace restored so they can start getting their lives rebuilt. This is at least what the families were telling us. But it is, for the most part, Mehdi Army. All the fighters that we met were Mehdi Army today, and they were all over.
Mm. Well, now this news of the spark in fighting has overshadowed the release of 9 hostages yesterday. We understand that in Fallujah, where 4 Jordanians were being held, it was Iraqi gunmen who actually led the raid on the militants who were holding the Jordanians and freed them, sort of sending the signal that they didn't want foreign militants in their midst.
Yeah, well, this is now a very common feeling these days. A lot of people are very they don't necessarily mind having an insurgency, but they would like to have it carried out by their own people. The foreign militants aren't entirely welcome, particularly in places like Fallujah, where there is support for insurgencies, homegrown ones, but not for the ones who have been. Oh, there's enough left. A blast just went off. Now we got bullets whizzing over.
Oh, well, I think you better get to safety. Scott?
Hello, can you hear me?
Ah, Scott, are you all right?
Yes, all is well. All is well. It just was, I'm getting used to the sound of bullets overhead.
Well, we think that you should get to safety. Is this part of just the sporadic fighting that you've been talking about in Najaf?
Yeah, it appears to have started up again. So anyway, we'll be in touch.
Yeah, Scott, take care.
Thank you.
Scott Baldoff of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us earlier today from Najaf.
According to Pakistani officials, photographs and maps of England's Heathrow Airport and of underpasses beneath some London buildings were among the images recently discovered on the computers of Al-Qaeda suspects. But British officials have reacted with their usual calm. General William Odom, former director of the National Security Agency, compared American and UK responses to terrorism during a congressional hearing yesterday.
Look at Britain and its struggle with the IRA for years. They don't run around following a policy of sustained hysteria about it. They've taken some pretty serious hits. But you get used to it, you keep it down, and you learn to not let the other guy force you to squander your resources.
Well, joining us on the line from London is Richard Evans, terror and insurgency editor at Jane's Intelligence Digest. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
How significant are these new arrests and the information that's come from them? Is this being viewed as big news there or simply additional pieces of information on top of what we already knew?
Well, it's very difficult to say at this early stage. A number of men have been detained in raids up and down the country. So far, no charges have been brought.
How is it being played in terms of public statements then? What are officials there saying about them?
Well, very little is being said publicly, but that's really not surprising. Generally speaking, the information that has been released to the public concerning terrorist threats has been of the order of occasional statements by the Home Secretary. Very few press conferences as such are given, and every so often to reinforce in the public consciousness that there is a terrorist threat out there. I think of late we're starting to see a slight change in that. Not in the approach, in as much as the message is still the same as it always was, be alert but don't be alarmed, but the way in which I think that message is delivered is changing slightly given the raised threat from Al-Qaeda and associated groups.
Well, changing in terms of ratcheting up somewhat, because I do remember that in March, British officials did say after the Spanish train bombing that they thought an attack on London might be inevitable, and then in February the British Army was called out to guard Heathrow after rumors of a possible surface-to-air missile attack.
Well, that's correct. I mean, I think the government, rather than allowing myth and misinformation about Al-Qaeda and the threat that it poses to rule the day, they are engaging now in a public information campaign which will include the mailing of simple information booklets out to every home in the country, providing basic instructions on what to do in the event that you find yourself in the vicinity of a large natural disaster or a terrorist attack. But even in spite of that, I think the message is pretty much the same as it's always been. Be alert, don't be alarmed, report any information you may have of relevance to terrorist threats to the authorities.
The New York Times said today in an editorial that the color code system wasn't working and should be junked, that it does no good for people to be told to be scared, more scared, or really scared, and then at the same time being told to act as if there's nothing wrong. I wonder, in your view, does the color code system make sense?
Well, a public color-coded threat matrix is not a system which the British government has traditionally adopted. The British approach, as I say, has generally been more low-key.
Richard, thank you.
My pleasure.
Richard Evans is terror and insurgency editor at Jane's Intelligence Digest.
Residents of 20 Palestinian towns are suing the Palestinian Authority. They claim that PA officials have been acting as middlemen between Egyptian cement companies and Israeli contractors, who then use the cement to build portions of the separation barrier between Israel and the Palestinian territories. Only about 5% of the 450-mile barrier consists of the tall cement wall, but it is the starkest symbol of the controversial barrier, and the Palestinian middlemen are also accused of skimming profits. Joining us on the line is Matt Rees, Jerusalem correspondent for Time magazine. And Matt, what's the history of this cement? Why isn't Israel buying it directly from Egypt?
Well, originally the company in Haifa in Israel was trying to do that, but there was a scandal in Egypt when it emerged that an Egyptian company was ready to sell. That Egyptian company was forced to back down because there are a lot of people in Egypt, despite the peace agreement between the two countries, who don't want relations. And they felt this cement would go towards building the Israeli security wall. What the Egyptian company and the Israeli company then did is find a way around it, and that's where these Palestinian officials came in. They agreed to make it look as though they were importing the Egyptian cement to the Palestinian territories, but then they sold it on at a higher price to the Israeli company.
Is there any question in your mind that that happened?
It's quite clear from this fairly detailed parliamentary report prepared by the Palestinian Legislative Council exactly who was involved, when they were doing these things, what the names of the companies were. None of those people have chosen to deny it. So, yes, it's quite clear that it did happen.
Well, so that brings us to the question we want to ask you. The Palestinians who are filing the suit against the Palestinian Authority, what are they most angry about?
They're angry really about the hypocrisy that's involved in this. They can see right in front of them, quite literally in concrete, that while their officials, Arafat on down, are running around the world talking about a racist wall, a new Berlin Wall, getting the UN General Assembly and the International Court of Justice to condemn it, at the same time, they're making almost $6 million in profit selling the cement that's used to build the wall. So it's the hypocrisy that really has got under the skin of Palestinians about this issue.
We understand that it's not unusual for Palestinians or the Palestinian Authority to be doing business with the Israeli government, but how unusual is it for a lawsuit to be filed on behalf of Palestinians against the PA?
Well, first of all, it is quite unusual for anyone to be so angry that they're prepared to go up against what is really quite a gangsterish authority in the first place. You know, who knows who can come around and get in your face about this, if you like, after dark. One of Arafat's own former ministers was shot in the leg and had to have it amputated very recently because he had criticized Arafat and his regime as being corrupt. So it's quite unusual that anyone should get that angry. On the other hand, even those who are involved in these suits don't believe there's much chance of success. The parliamentary report was given to the Attorney General, who's appointed by Arafat, and he's still refusing to acknowledge that he's even got the report, let alone follow up on its recommendations to prosecute some of the companies and some of the officials who were involved in this scandal.
And briefly, we just have a few seconds. What does this reflect in the bigger sense, the fact that, as you said, this unusual lawsuit was filed? What's going on?
What we've seen in the last couple of weeks is an absolutely that the Palestinian people and a lot of, in fact, Arafat's own supporters within his Fatah party have really had it up to here with the corruption, particularly when on the other side, the diplomatic side, they're in a dead end. As long as things were getting better for them, they could ignore the corruption. But now you've got the corruption and a political dead end. Something's got to give, and that's what Palestinian people are feeling right now.
Matt Rees, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Matt Rees, Jerusalem correspondent for Time magazine.
Just ahead, U.S.-Pakistan relations. The word on the street is that Pakistan wants another 4 years of George W. Bush.
And later, is OPEC powerless to rein in record oil prices?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
When Pakistan announced that it had captured several key al-Qaeda figures last Friday, there was open speculation in the United States that the news was timed to draw attention away from Democratic candidate John Kerry's speech the night before. Well, true or not, similar rumors are swirling through Pakistan that the government wants George Bush reelected, that it produces al-Qaeda captives on demand, that Osama bin Laden himself lies dead in a Pakistani mortuary waiting to be unveiled in an October surprise. Joining us in our studio is Adil Najam, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Welcome, Adil.
Thank you.
And on the line from Spain is Ahmed Rashid, a correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review, who is normally based in Pakistan. Welcome, Ahmed.
Hello.
Ahmed, let me start with you. What are the rumors that you're hearing in Pakistan now?
Well, there's certainly enormous amount of speculation that General Musharraf will deliver, if not bin Laden, at least top al-Qaeda leaders before the November elections in the U.S. But, you know, I mean, there's nothing firm about this. And when one hears these rumors about deliver, one is presuming that somehow these al-Qaeda leaders are already in the hands of the Pakistani intelligence services. I don't think that is the case at all. I think what we're seeing now is certainly a stepped-up effort by the Pakistani intelligence, along with the CIA and the FBI, to try and help along Bush's campaign by nabbing as many al-Qaeda as possible.
And, Adil, what's your take on that? Is it a matter of ramping up the effort to find more terrorists as opposed to having a group of them that you bring out one by one when you need to?
Yeah. I agree with Ahmed. I don't think there's a stockpile of terrorists that the Pakistan government has waiting in some room and you just take one out and deliver whenever there's a demand. But there is certainly jacked-up demand from the U.S. at various points, and that leads to jacked-up efforts by the Pakistan establishment. And that usually does lead to some sort of an arrest, sometimes important, sometimes not. But it's not as if bin Laden and others are sitting in a room waiting to be called at the behest of the Bush administration.
And is it reasonable to assume that, in fact, the Pakistani government would like to see George Bush reelected?
I think the military establishment would prefer. Historically, yes, there has been what I think is a historical coincidence that Republican presidents have tended to be A, better for military regimes in Pakistan, and B, better and closer to Pakistan in general. But that's not because they were Republicans. That is simply because what was happening in the world at that time, for example, the Afghanistan War and Ronald Reagan, or Nixon and China, or Eisenhower and the Cold War.
And Ahmed, I'd like to hear from you on that. And also to the public feeling as well, even if the government might prefer a Republican administration, George Bush is not popular among the Pakistani public, is he?
No, he's certainly not popular, and he's probably the least popular president that the Americans have ever had, not just Islamic fundamentalists, but across the entire political spectrum, the political parties, intellectuals, the media would all like to see Bush go. You know, Kerry has not distanced himself from any significant policies of Bush regarding Pakistan, South Asia, Afghanistan as yet. But I think what tends to happen in democratic administrations is that there are very powerful lobbies. For example, the non-proliferation lobby in the United States is mostly Democrat. And I think you have probably get a much tougher position from a Kerry administration on the proliferation that Pakistan has done in the past to other countries than you have had already from the Bush administration.
And is it fair to say that it's not just Pakistan that feels this way?
I think it's generally true across the region. We should understand that all these dictatorial regimes in the region, and I'm thinking here particularly of the Central Asian republics, have benefited hugely from the war against terrorism. The situation in Central Asia is probably far worse now regarding political freedom and economic livelihoods than it was before 9/11. And the Bush administration is turning a blind eye to that. So what we're seeing is the kind of deals that the administration has made with authoritarian or dictatorial leaders in the region have benefited these leaders enormously, and they don't want to see a change in Washington.
And Adil, I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about this dilemma facing the Pakistani leadership. It's one thing for the government perhaps to be pro-Bush, but if your people are not with you on that, that's a risk.
Well, that's when being a military government helps. There's also the sense, I think, that Pakistan, both people and government, understand that Pakistan would be an easy country to beat up on. During the Kerry campaign, if Kerry wants to distance himself very visibly from something that Bush is doing, Pakistan would be an easy case to say this is not what I would have done, unlike many other things where it's difficult for him to say that.
And so, Ahmed, let me ask you in conclusion, what do you see as happening next here? There is more information today about these new Pakistani arrests with surveillance photos of Heathrow Airport and so on. These arrests do seem to be paying off. I mean, what are you looking for to happen next?
I think we should remember that The whole of last year, the U.S. intelligence apparatus, that is the agencies, the satellites, the human intelligence on the ground, everything that was on the Pakistan-Afghanistan border trying to track down al-Qaeda was shifted to the Iraqi battlefield. Much of this intelligence, special forces, etc., only started trickling back to Afghanistan in March of this year. You're getting better human intelligence, you're getting better surveillance, satellite surveillance, telephone surveillance, etc., which is putting pressure, of course, on the Pakistanis. I think most of these arrests have taken place because of information provided by the FBI or CIA, and once they pinpoint locations and people to the Pakistanis have gone after them quite vigorously. So we're seeing a stepped-up action, not just related to the American elections, I think, but related to the simple fact that the U.S. is back in a big way after ignoring al-Qaeda because of Iraq.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ahmed Rashid is a Pakistan-based correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review. Adil Najam is a professor of international relations at the Fletcher School at Tufts University.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, how is the Arab world reacting to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11? That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It's common knowledge that oil in Iraq is plentiful, but no one can say exactly how much is there, and figuring that out could be an important step towards modernizing and rebuilding the Iraqi oil industry, and perhaps rebuilding the country with the profits. That's why the Iraqi oil ministry is calling for bids for comprehensive evaluations of the two biggest oil fields in the country. Joining us on the line from Cyprus is Waleed Kaddouri, editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey. And Waleed, it would be nice to know, but why else is it important to know the amount of oil in Iraq?
The study on these two fields, Kirkuk and Rumaila, these are old fields. Kirkuk started production in 1927. And for the past 25 years, because of the wars and the sanction, there has been no proper evaluation of the amount of reserves left in these fields and the pressure in them. So what this study plans to do is to see exactly how much more oil can be extracted from these fields over the next few years, and also what is needed, gas pressure, water pressure, in order to enhance production and sustain it as long as possible.
That's important information for rebuilding the Iraqi oil industry, but we also understand that, you know, with oil prices soaring, and we're going to have more on that in a moment, that news of a strong supply in Iraq could go a long way to calm the markets.
Well, that's true. I mean, we know there's a lot of oil in Iraq. That's a proven thing. The problem is to get it out to the markets. And Iraq is now producing at less than half its capacity. And because of the problems that have encroached in the past two or three decades, Iraq has not been able to really build its capacity to the fullest. So this study is just a small piece in a long process of rebuilding and rehabilitating the Iraqi oil industry to bring it up from the current level of around 2.5 million barrels a day to a production level of around 5 or 6 million barrels a day by the end of the decade.
What's the competition been like for these bids? These are small contracts to do the survey, but are people assuming that whoever gets the bid to do the survey will be involved in future development and a lot of money made from the actual oil that's found?
No, there is competition, but it is not really a major bid. This is a small piece in the big puzzle. This is just evaluating two old fields. The big projects will be in developing Iraq's new fields, fields that have been discovered in the past 20 years or so, 30 years, but have not been developed. That's where the competition will be.
Some people found it surprising that in the early round of bidding for the contracts for the surveys, Halliburton didn't put in a bid.
Now, Halliburton is involved in rehabilitation. I'm not sure that Halliburton is involved in field studies like this one. I think this would be the work of Exxon, of Shell, BP, Total, companies of that sort. And, I mean, there's a lot of controversy, of course, about Halliburton, but I'm not sure that this specific contract is controversial as such.
Security in Iraq, as we know, is still pretty tenuous, especially when it comes to foreign workers, and these are foreign companies making the bids. What is your sense as to how long it might take for companies to even get in and do a survey?
That's a very good question, and it's a crucial question. Many international oil companies have stated publicly that they will not work in Iraq until there is stability, there is security. That, what they mean by that, they will not do any development work in Iraq. They will not develop any fields. Now, to do a survey of this sort, a lot of the work will really be in their headquarter offices with their computers. So in that sense, this is a doable agreement. One hopes that it can be done and the time allotted for it.
Your educated guess, how long between, you know, doing a survey, finding how much oil there is, and then actually getting it to the market?
You know, maybe 2 or 3 years time.
Waleed Khoudouri, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Waleed Khoudouri, editor-in-chief of the Middle East Economic Survey, he spoke to us from Cyprus.
It's time to open up the Here and Now mailbag and air some of your thoughts.
We heard from Beth Nishon from Deep River, Connecticut, after our report on a Harvard study showing more women taking their husband's last name when they marry. Beth writes, "It worries me that this may be because they feel that feminism has done all it can for womankind. But while some battles have been won, the war is not over. Currently, there are only 14 female senators out of 100, for example, and women still get paid far less than men at the same education levels. I am 28, and I kept my last name to make a statement. I am not afraid to call myself a feminist. I wish more young women felt the same."
Our story about how the media covered the Democratic National Convention drew this response from Michelle Grecius. "I hope that the news coverage of the Republican National Convention in September by network and cable channels is just as terrible as it was for the DNC. This will give each convention fair and equal coverage."
In our review of Jonathan Demme's remake of The Manchurian Candidate, host Michael Goldfarb asked, in part, if this was just more liberal propaganda, which brought this co-letter from Jerry Landay, associate professor at the University of Illinois, and James Deacon, a retired White House correspondent. They write, "We believe in the constitutional guarantee of free speech, but we do not accept your craven retreat before organs of the radical right trying to make liberalism into a pejorative, riding roughshod over the histories of FDR, Truman, Kennedy, Johnson, and others."
And this correction, our post-convention analyst David Nyan confused his generals. David had said that General John Shalikashvili, who spoke at the convention on John Kerry's behalf, was cashiered by Donald Rumsfeld for speaking out about troop strength in Iraq. Listener David Bryant of Brookline, Massachusetts, wrote, "In fact, it was General Eric Shinseki who made the very public and accurate projections of the need for more troops in Iraq during congressional testimony. He was the Army's chief of staff at the time. Retired General Shalley had been chairman of the Joint Chiefs during the early Clinton years."
And finally, we heard from Tucson native Dave McMahon. "After our conversation with Ken Ellingwood, author of Hard Line, Life and Death Along the U.S.-Mexico Border, Dan writes, what no one ever says is the ongoing problems along the border are good for business. Illegal immigrant labor keeps labor costs unrealistically low. Substantial increases to the Border Patrol don't just create jobs for agents, but also in the private sector, with the construction of new facilities to house detainees, for example. The situation seems to benefit everyone except the immigrants, who risk death, and the taxpayers, who foot the bill when migrants require state-funded hospitalization. There are two general approaches to solving the problem that will never be implemented because both result result in higher retail prices. One would legitimize completely the migrant labor force, which would remove any motive for anyone crossing the desert except to smuggle drugs or transport terrorists into the U.S. The second involves enforcing existing immigration laws. Under this approach, employers would be penalized severely for violating immigration laws, thus ending the demand for labor from Mexico.
As always, we love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org.
Or you can give us a call, 617-358-0397. Please include your name, number, and town.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
With oil prices climbing briefly to $44 a barrel earlier this week before retreating to a still high $42 a barrel, many are concerned that the biggest player in the petroleum world, OPEC, might be powerless to stop the increases. OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, finds its hands tied. They say they're pumping oil as fast as they can because of the unusually small margin of spare capacity. Vijay Vasithwaran covers the oil industry for The Economist. He joins us on the line from New York. Vijay, first of all, what's going on with oil prices? Why is the market so volatile, you know, outside of OPEC?
At the moment, it's a question of supply and demand. The demand for oil has been unexpectedly strong. The U.S. economic recovery has been strong, and places like China are growing at extraordinary rates of growth. That's something that OPEC hadn't counted on a couple of years ago when they were making their investment decisions on how much new capacity to build. As a result, the world supply of oil is quite tight. Virtually every country in the world is producing maximum capacity. And so we're really left in a market that's the tightest it's been in almost 30 years. There's virtually no point, except during the run-up to the first Gulf War, when there was a tighter supply and demand picture. That's why prices are so high.
And by the way, you left out Russia, the volatility in the market there. And as we just heard earlier on the program, that the Iraq oil isn't flowing and isn't going to be for several years, at least in the amount people thought. So are you saying that analysts trust OPEC's claim that they can't pump anymore?
There is very little doubt, and you don't need to take OPEC's goodwill at these prices, at $44, when the lifting cost of oil out of the ground in Saudi Arabia is barely a dollar. You can bet that anybody that's got oil that they can get to market is rushing to get it to market. Let's not forget that just a few years ago, in 1999, the oil price was $10 a barrel, and many companies were losing money, or it's certainly the it was a very, very difficult profit picture for countries and companies. So at $40 oil, anybody that's got it is rushing to get it to market.
And by the way, for those who don't follow this market, what's the average for a barrel?
Right about now, the global market is costing about $44 a barrel. That we're paying around $1.50 to $2 at the pump per gallon. When you say average, it changes over time. 5 years ago, it was only $10. Through most of the 90s, we were around $20 a barrel, just to give a rough idea.
We understand in response to this debate in the media and elsewhere that Saudi Arabian officials have rushed to say, oh, no, we're bringing new oil online with new fields. But in about the minute we have left, how long does that take realistically, and is that realistically going to happen?
It will take time. There's no question. Oil fields can't be started up overnight. It takes enormous amounts of investments and lag time of months to the time frame of a few years. Now, the good news is there have been projects that were already underway, and the Saudis have indicated that they're bringing some fields on a little earlier than planned. They're shutting down old fields a little slower than they had planned. In other words, there's a little bit of a buffer, but not very much. And in the short term, meaning the next few weeks to perhaps the next few months, there's very little cushion at all. And bear in mind that we don't have a war going on. Mm-hmm. If we were to have, or a major catastrophe, if we were to have a real shutdown in all of Venezuela, like happened last year due to a national strike, or Nigeria because of civil strife, or more problems in Iraq, or all those things happen at once.
Yeah, it'll only get worse.
It can only get worse, exactly.
Well, Vijay, on that note, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Vijay Vethaswaran covers the oil industry for The Economist. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
50 years, 50. That's how long the Newport Jazz Festival has been around. And next weekend, some of the best names in jazz will be on hand to mark that milestone. So we have asked Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs to come in and review the festival's rich history and also give us a preview of next weekend's lineup. So, James, thanks so much for being here.
How are you, Gail?
Very well, thanks. You know, so much history and music to talk about. So let's get right to it. First, how did this start?
It started with two socialites, the Lorillards, Lewis and his wife Elaine of the tobacco family Lorillards, and they enlisted the services of a young man from Boston, a sometime pianist and at that time a full-time club operator, George Ween. And George Ween very rapidly put this thing together. I think they started plans for it in April of 1954, and the first night of the festival was July the 17th, 1954. There were 13,000 people, which was a surprise that it drew that well in damp, mostly depressing weather, I understand. It did very well.
And also I understand that George was able to get very different musicians to perform with each other who might not do that otherwise.
Well, that was part of the idea, to bring together musicians from different musical milieu. For example, this first tune that we're going to hear, recorded in 1963 by the genius composer-pianist Thelonious Monk. And here, his quartet is paired with the clarinetist Pee Wee Russell. And in the solo that we're going to hear, at least a snippet of it, it seems to me that Pee Wee plays at least part of his solo to approximate the way in which Monk played the piano. Toward the end, da, 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 ba, da, da. The jagged harmony, that's Blue Monk, by the way, Thelonious Monk's original blues. Now, I don't know if Pee Wee was consciously trying to pay tribute to Monk or having a little laugh or whatever, but he was a true individualist in jazz, Charles Ellsworth Pee Wee Russell, wonderful player.
Well, those are some of the performers from years past. What about this year's lineup?
Well, first of all, Gail, this year's lineup, in addition to being extraordinary, it's on three different stages at Fort Adams State Park. It would just take us too long to run down even half of the first-rate players and singers at this year's event. I'll say this, though. The accent, to a certain degree, is on pianists and on female performers, players and singers. Quickly scanning this list in front of me, we have Herbie Hancock and Wayne Shorter's quartet, the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra with Wynton Marsalis. This is really, I think, the best JVC Newport Festival ever.
Well, let's pick two names, Ornette Coleman, Jerry Allen. They're performing separately, but they have recorded together.
They have. In the mid-1990s, they recorded a couple of albums. Ornette was the leader. Ornette wails on this particular tune. He's the alto player. Jerry Allen is the pianist, and this Ornette Coleman original is Stopwatch. Incidentally, that drummer is Ornette's son, Donardo Coleman. Ornette will be appearing with a quartet, and Jerry Allen will be part of Bill Cosby's Cause of Good Music. And on the same day, Jerry Allen will be appearing with her husband, Wallace Roney, who is a very good trumpet player.
And every year at Newport, the perennial crowd favorite, Dave Brubeck. Do I hear a little Take Five in the offing?
You're going to hear a little Take Five from the year 2002, as opposed to 1959, I think, was when the original was recorded. Brubeck is a marvel. He's 83. He's had some health issues. He's come back. He still tours the world. He still composes. And he's had this working group with Bobby Militello on reeds for quite a while now, and they're always extremely popular, as is this tune, Take Five.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a recent recording of Take Five by the Dave Brubeck Quartet. Anyone else we should be keeping our ears and our eyes open for?
Well, among the new performers, Regina Carter, violinist. She plays jazz pieces, classical, etc., and she has such a beautiful tone. Regina Carter from Detroit, Michigan.
Jazz violinist Regina Carter, and the piece was Reverie.
Yeah, in fact, a classical piece by Debussy, but given the jazz treatment.
Well, James, thanks so much for taking us back and also looking forward to 50 years of the Newport Jazz Festival. There is a 3-CD set called Happy Birthday, Newport, 50 Swinging Years. So let's go out on another number from that CD.
Now, this is probably the most famous single performance ever recorded at Newport. It's Duke Ellington and his orchestra. And when one asked his date of birth, he said, "I was born July 7th, 1956 at Newport, Rhode Island."
Here and Now's jazz aficionado, James Isaacs. And for more information on the 50th anniversary of the Newport Jazz Festival, check out our website at here-now.org.
Truman Capote, Albert Camus, World War II, the death of Gandhi, all were immortalized by photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, who died yesterday at the age of 95. Cartier-Bresson helped to found Magnum Photography. John Morris was editor there in the 50s. He was also a photographer and a lifelong friend of Cartier-Bresson's. We asked him earlier today to share his thoughts.
Henri is being credited quite falsely with being the father of photojournalism. That's not true. If anyone was to be called that, it should be Eric Solomon, the German photographer who began photographing for Berliner Illustrated in the late 20s. But Henri does indeed deserve, to me, the reputation of the greatest photographer of the 20th century, because his photographs sum up history. They symbolize history in the most powerful, graphic way. The thing about Henri is that it's expressed in his phrase about the decisive moment, which will be quoted over and over as people write about him. But the conjunction of form and content was the important thing. His photographs, in short, were symbolic of an event. I once went with him to the United States Capitol when Richard Nixon was vice president. He had an assignment from Vogue to photograph the vice president. This was just before the election of 1960. And we had to wait in a big ceremonial office for Nixon to be photographed with Miss Idaho Potato Queen. And then we were introduced by Nixon's secretary. And I was amazed at how few pictures Cartier-Bresson took. He obviously sized him up very, very quickly. But the one that made Vogue was the moment that Nixon clenched his fist, and one got a sense of his political strength just from that gesture. It's also interesting that Henri thought so little of Nixon that he didn't include him in his book of portraits.
Photographer John Morris on the line from Paris, speaking of his late friend Henri Cartier-Bresson.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Thank you.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.